is an interview with Dr. Roswell Boutwell in a conference room at the top of McArdle Laboratory. The date is June 13. I'm Molly Loss. So Dr. Boutwell, we've been talking in the previous interview about the sort of logical direction of your research. So I'd like to know, after you established the biological aspects of tumor formation, what direction did the research take after that?
Well, the direction after that is to determine the molecular changes that take place in cells during these various stages that we had defined, the various biological steps in the process. And by defining these metabolic, biochemical, molecular changes, one has a basis for developing agents that will prevent those changes and thereby prevent the tumors from developing. It'll be a chemotherapy as the ultimate goal of these steps that we'll be talking about now. And so with respect to initiation, the first step involves the reaction of the agent, a complete carcinogen at a low dose, as was described in the biology, as an initiating agent. What does that small dose do? It will combine or cause a mistake in the DNA of the epithelial tissue, the tissue that we're interested in, that mistake is generally correctable or repaired is the word I'm looking for. You can exit those. Those defects that are caused in DNA by an initiator, a carcinogen at a low dose, can be repaired. But they're repaired at a slow rate, and some of them are present in a mouse skin for months. And that's when you can show that those changes have taken place in the DNA by treating with an initiator instead of just as soon as you've, by treating with a promoter, not just as soon as you treated with an initiator, but some weeks or months later, you will still get the tumors, although nothing has been shown up, histology of the cells. There's still that defect in DNA there, and no morphological effect, but the effect of its presence there, the alkylation of a DNA by an initiator, is revealed by treating with the promoter. And what is revealed is many tumors, and then we start looking for the changes. We find that within 45 minutes there is a major increase in the rate of synthesis of RNA in the mouse skin epidermis, and that is the first step in the that always takes place as cell division begins. First, there is an increase in RNA. It's transient. It came to a peak in our case in about 45 minutes and then begins to fall off. That's followed by an increased synthesis of protein. And then that peaks and begins to fall off. And then it's finally manifest as increase in DNA synthesis. And so that's the final step then in promotion metabolically. So we have a model system to undertake a rational study and search for the molecules that can prevent these reactions and would be specific for tumor formation. So we started with chemicals that were already known in the literature for other purposes. For example, we could use, we learned that the effect after these increases in RNA, DNA, and protein now we come to the, you're going to have to erase some of this stuff.
Okay.
We come to the business that we talked about last time. Polyamines
mm-hmm.
are increased in embryonic tissue, in wound tissue, and in cancer tissue. The polyamines are at a high level. It's characteristic of rapidly dividing tissue. They were discovered in Germany. Did I talk about that
you
before? You can insert that here, I guess. And there are a number of compounds, I guess I said, that are known to inhibit that reaction. And so we started out with those that are known to inhibit the increase in putrescine, spermidine, and spermine, the polyamines that are elevated in rapidly dividing tissue. And the first agents that we found or that we tested to make a comparison between the in vitro study, the literal production of tumors, and the measurement of the ornithine decarboxylase activity as such could be started. And we started with the things that were already known to inhibit cell division, and these included things like colchicine, which is used for treating gout in medicine. Indomethacin is a compound that had been known to inhibit cell division and inhibit the accumulation of polyamines. The retinoic acid, vitamin A, was known to inhibit cell division. And so we started out with those and found that they, in our laboratory system, inhibited the accumulation of polyamines. And that was new information.
Mm-hmm. So you throughout your narrative, you talk about we as the people who are researching it. Who were your collaborators?
Well, I had an excellent bunch of collaborators. I didn't concentrate on numbers, I concentrated on quality. And Verma was one of them, who ultimately ended up as a professor in the human oncology department. The person that actually did the work on the first of the polyamine work was Tom O'Brien, who left for Pittsburgh and was connected with and had a good position and continued heavily important contributions to this area in his work in one of the big cancer institutes in Pittsburgh. In Philadelphia, I beg your pardon.
So I know Verma was your student. Was Tom O'Brien also your student?
students had as much to do with this, and sometimes more, than I had.
Yeah.
We depended in my group on conversations, and as just as soon as the graduate student or the postdoctoral fellow, Verma came as a postdoctoral fellow and O'Brien as a graduate student, as soon as I saw that their ideas were better than mine, I tried to get a technician to help them in their experiments, and I was careful to use my grant money to get technicians for these really good students, good researchers. And so they did accomplish an awful lot of what we've talked about here. So let me get my wits a second. Collected here a minute, so you might as well turn that
off.
Okay. We started with compounds that had been proven by, were established in the literature as inhibitors of cell division, colchicine and indomethacin, acetyl salicylic acid, which is aspirin, vitamin A, the cortisones, corticoids, adrenal corticoids, which in my very first paper was shown to be important in the prevention of, was found to be highly active in animals that were calorie restricted. But at that time, cortisol, the kind of compounds that were synthesized by the adrenal cortex, the adrenal steroids, were unavailable. An animal, a person, only makes about 20 milligrams of cortisol a day, and to get it from human or animal sources was just prohibitively inexpensive, and to test the products of the adrenal steroids specifically waited for the ability to get cortisol, the pure chemical that is the product of the adrenal steroid of the adrenal cortex, and wait until that was synthesized, and that I think was about 1908 before that was available, and so that could be included in this list of things that we were studying. Also, it was known that tosylysine chloromethyl ketone, a relatively complex compound, TLCK, you can use for abbreviation, was discovered by another person working in the molecular changes that were important in tumor promotion, found that that compound TLCK, a protein synthesis inhibitor, inhibited tumor promotion. And that's really quite obvious, because tumor promotion is a big part of cell division. And he had found that compound important, and so we incorporated that in our research. By comparing the effects of these compounds at the doses used in our animal experiments and comparing those doses with the effect on the polyamine synthesis, we compared them. And based on what caused a particular effect on the metabolic, or on the amounts of the polyamines, it was through the same range of dose that affected the tumor promoting activity. So it was just a strong evidence that the polyamines were important, because it paralleled perfectly in dosage the all matters, it was a perfect parallel with a tumor formation. Well, this was causing interest in the polyamines, caused interest in a pharmaceutical company, Merrill Dow. And so it had been known for years that fluorine atom in a chemical compound would occupy about the same amount of area, and this becomes important in enzymology, it's about the same size as a hydrogen atom in a compound. And so putting fluorine in a compound in the place of hydrogen was a tremendously effective inhibitor. With the normal hydrogen atom in your compound you're considering, the hydrogen is easily not only put into the compound but removed from the compound, and the enzyme doesn't notice the difference between the size of the molecule, and that's what enzymes do. It's a structural relationship with the inhibitor. It doesn't recognize the difference in size, but the difference in chemical reactivity is complete. The fluorine cannot be eliminated from the inhibitor by the chemical we're talking about. And so it is an inhibitor of the enzyme. It's a poison of the enzyme, and that made a good compound to study. And so Merrill Dow did synthesize difluoromethylornithine, and that too allowed us to do what these other compounds I was talking about that are specific for ornithine decarboxylase, the colchicine, the vitamin A, and so on. DFMO was highly specific for blocking the synthesis in the animal of putrescine, spermidine, and spermine, the polyamines. I'm going to have to stop and collect my wits here. We next wanted to compare the level of all these compounds that inhibit polyamine synthesis, compare the levels that are effective in preventing that synthesis in a short assay that can be completed in a day in the laboratory with the long term that takes months to produce the epithelial tumors in a living animal. And we found that the amounts in all these things were completely parallel. The amount of colchicine or vitamin A that would inhibit the production of polyamines in the intact animal were, and in the short-term assay, were exactly the same as inhibited the tumors in the long-term assay. So that was a big step forward. There was a rational method to look for tumor inhibitors by a short-term laboratory study rather than waiting months for tumors to develop in the animal. It only took a day's work to do that in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. And so when the Merrill Dow heard about the importance of polyamines in tumor promotion, they thought they would synthesize this compound that would block the enzyme reaction and be highly specific instead of indirectly having an effect on polyamine synthesis as vitamin A does. And difluoromethylornithine is completely specific blocker. About that time, I went over to see Dr. Carbone and try and interest him in doing a clinical study to prevent tumors in people. Dr. Carbone had come to Wisconsin from the National Cancer Institute, and he had established a very good reputation as somebody that was good at preventing cancer with specific compounds. And so when I went over and tried to interest him in something like aspirin, the acetyl salicylic acid that is easy to use and doesn't have many side effects except to stomach, and these can be controlled and can be used in long-term studies, and colchicine and such, I couldn't interest him in anything except that Miraldal DFMO. The trouble with that was that it was such a narrow range between toxicity and therapeutic activity. And among other things, it interfered with hearing, all sorts of miserable things for humans. And so that was a difficult study, and it was not working really well. But unfortunately, Dr. Carbone, who had a research relationship with a Near Eastern company, university, died while over there suddenly, and that project came to a stop. But eventually, after I'd come back from Japan, Verma and a younger man under Dr. Carbone continued that study and published it, and showed that that was a very specific reaction to block ODC, which verified all our previous studies with less specific inhibitors of polyamine synthesis, such as retinoic acid. The next thing that I went on to do in the last year or two before I left to go to Japan in 1984 was to try combinations of these agents that prevent synthesis to some extent of polyamines, because they were acting by different mechanisms. And sometimes when you add such things together at still lower levels than you normally would use to prevent synthesis of polyamines, when you combine them together that act in different ways, there is a synergistic effect. And sure enough, that's what occurred. When we gave animals retinoic acid, and for example, a protein inhibitor, which is a very general inhibitor of tumor promotion and inhibitor of a lot of other things, because tumor protein synthesis is important to life. But a low level of the inhibitor TLCK and of retinoic acid could just about completely inhibit the production of polyamines. And in the animal experiment, instead of getting maybe 15 tumors per mouse at 3 months, we got absolutely no tumors at those extended periods of time in the live animal experiments. But unfortunately, I presented those data in one in a research program where members of the General Motors committee that decided who was to get these big dollar rewards from General Motors. It was supposed to be the what's the big scientific prize for science and medical research?
The Nobel or the Lasker Award?
The Scandinavian countries.
Nobel?
Nobel. It was going to be the cancer equivalent of the Nobel Award. And General Motors was going to get lots of good publicity. So there was a very select period committee selected to decide on who was making these big contributions. But then that committee had some, each year that we met, we'd have little discussions where each of us would get up and present some of their own research. Unfortunately, I presented our work with these combinations to that committee, and then it was published in their book, and they, for several years, they had a publication of a book, and it showed, among other things, the results of their own symposia. And so that, and one other presentation that I made myself, and not published, but not subject to peer review, but published as a scientific publication without peer review in a book form. So that was never reviewed, never published and reviewed properly, and never got well established into research. And just as Merrill Dow was interested in this and started to make and did make difluoromethyl ornithine, many people all around the country, particularly clinicians, some out in Arizona, I remember, and some in one of the California University, started studying the sort of thing as we did in human beings. And some of them did use vitamin A and those types of compounds and had results, but some also tried this same thing that Dr. Carbone studied, the difluoromethyl ornithine, and all of them showed effects, but I don't think very many of them picked up this double combination. And about that time was when I had come back from Japan and really fully retired, and much of it was not successful. The difluoromethyl ornithine wasn't feasible to use clinically, and nowadays you hear people finding that and reporting that aspirin inhibits various human tumors, and the basis for that is our primary findings. But by now, when they're beginning to find the effect of things like aspirin as an inhibitor in epidemiological studies, it's so many years after the work that explains that effect took place that it isn't even realized by the clinicians that are observing this, the mechanism that explains the effect.
Were there any other, along with aspirin, were there any other basic discoveries that you made in the course of your career that later became important for public health or cancer treatment?
Well, I think that was by far the most important and a major finding. We also had studies going with other graduate students on the receptor for uh, uh, This is like when I couldn't think of difluoromethyl ornithine 2 weeks ago. Yeah, I'm just going, I just got a blocks on all these things. Boy, I tell you, that's why I say if this had only happened a year ago, I was so much better mental shape.
That's okay. We can skip that question. Okay. Can I ask you about your research funding? So over the course of your career, where did the majority of your research funding come from?
The first source of money that brought me to McArdle, Dr. Rush, right after World War II, the American Cancer Society really came to life and had enough money to make a few grants. And Dr. Rush, and it was called the Committee on Growth at the American Cancer Society. Dr. Elvium was a member of the Committee on Growth that decided who got these fellowships, this money. And I'm sure it wasn't why Dr. Rush was one that got him. I'm sure Dr. Rush got it on his own reputation and ability to make a grant application. But he came over to McArdle and asked me if I wouldn't come over to, he came over to Biochem and wouldn't ask me if I wouldn't be like to come over to McArdle and do studies on cancer research because he had this grant from the American Cancer Society Committee on Growth. And that was when I did the calorie restriction study and found that adrenal corticoids were secreted in an increased level in animals that were calorie restricted. And in general, moderate stress is present in people who do these long distance runs and the triathlons and that sort of thing. They keep themselves under a moderate stress condition, quite different from this clinical condition of emotional stress that is serious. These are minor stresses, relatively speaking, that are healthy stresses, but are stresses on the adrenal steroid levels.
So over the, still thinking about the question of funding, did you find it difficult to secure funding in your career? Was it generally easy?
Well, I sure spent hours hoping that grants would be granted, but I don't think I was ever refused a grant. Dr. Verma, when he was over in human oncology, carried on studies somewhat like this and with animals, and I think he had an NIH study for over 25 years without any problems, and that Betty could answer that. I think that was a pretty good record in grants from NIH. But I don't ever remember not getting a grant, but it wasn't over as long a period as that because we had our group grants here, and Betty can tell you better what they are.
You mean, group grants it's NIH PPG grants?
Yes.
Yes, can you tell me a little more about them, please?
Well, I can't tell you any
okay.
more about that.
That's been program project grants.
These program project grants, McArdle as a whole got them. And while there still were cutoff points that weren't real good, I think we were getting our program project grants regularly. And so I also got most of my money eventually from the program project grants.
I see. Huh. Private fund foundations play a large role in your funding? I know the American Cancer Society would be one, but were there other groups?
Did you ask about our own local grant?
Yeah, did WARF give you money?
McArdle, at least for years and years, had the idea that they would not compete with the rest of the campus for these grants because we could get our grants nationally. And there weren't as many sources of funding nationally for some scientific research as there was for cancer, and so we stayed with our national grants and didn't go to the local sources.
I see. So I know you were on a number of committees during your career. Do you feel like your committee work was complementary to your research work?
Most of it was helpful, but a lot of it was pure doing it for the good of the research in general. But it certainly was stimulating to get applications and evaluate them. It was mentally stimulating, and it was worthwhile. And I certainly was on committees for a long time. American Cancer Society institutional grants. I was chairman of that for at least 10 years, then for several NIH committees for maybe 3 years at a time, which was the usual commitment. And those were educational in general and mentally stimulating and fun to take part in.
Which committees were the most memorable?
Oh gosh, I can't even remember the names.
Yeah. Well, I know you were on the National Cancer Advisory Board beginning in the 80s. So, you know, with that, you're really setting the sort of priorities for national cancer research.
It was the board of directors for that institute, and the National Cancer Institute had by far the largest budget of any institute because of that cure cancer business that was begun some years ago by the President of the United States as a general policy, and so it was well funded, yes.
What kind of work did you do?
Well, we were the board of directors that decided where money should be, and so those of us from McArdle had become members through the years of that committee, such as Pito, and wasn't Betty Miller was on that committee. We certainly championed, as opposed to some of these more expensive, but just fishing experiments, not based on good scientific method, many of these human studies. So we all lobbied strongly as members of the board that these not to penalize these research grants in the forming of their budget, where they'd allow a certain percentage of their budget for basic research such as done at McArdle and such as the study sections would review. But of course there were study sections for the human studies and for some of these very expensive studies that would take several times the total amount going for basic research just to do one clinical long-term study. So that was the fun and the battle of the National Cancer Institute. And I guess I preceded, I think maybe Heidelberg, did he precede me on the, or When did he get on that committee? I think he was too. But anyhow, it came a few years before I went to Japan, and they liked me so well that even when I went to Japan, I was on that longer than the usual period of time, and they paid to bring me back from Japan two or three times a year to continue on that, but finally I retired from that. I don't recall the detail.
I see. I know you were also on the Council for Tobacco Research's Scientific Advisory Board. How did you get involved with that board?
Well, I'm not sure, but it's because somebody that was already on the board knew me, and the tobacco research group was formed, of course, to protect the interest of the industry, and it did blacken your reputation to some extent to be on that committee, but also it was a good committee, and they did support a certain amount of basic research, and again I could serve as a person that would get as much money as possible out of their budget into basic research instead of into studies that would give the tobacco industry a reason for justifying their existence.
Mm-hmm. Did you find working with that board different from other boards you worked with?
Well, there were just enough good scientists so that it again was fun and new and stimulating, and we would just, those of us that were represented the basic science would just review those kinds of grants and try and give them a priority that could compete for that. In order to get good credibility, the chairman of those were often people that had been in basic research and had an established reputation, so it had its pluses and minuses.
I see.
As you would expect with tobacco money coming into them.
Yeah, and if I may ask, did you said that it being on the board might put a slight tarnish on a person's reputation. Is this something that you felt personally or not?
If it probably could, but I don't think it did, because among people that were doing basic research and the many, many people that were involved in the biology of the two-step formation of skin tumors, they knew the people that were honestly
yeah.
interested, and so it didn't give me any bad reputation in the field I was active in, I don't think.
I see. I know you won the American Association for Cancer Research's the CLOSE Award in 1979.
Yeah.
What was it like to win the award?
His name was Clues, I think, wasn't
okay.
it? Well, I don't like to talk about it.
Okay.
It was something that several people from McArdle were fortunate enough to get. Paper, presentation was usually published in Cancer Research afterwards. I never published it because I felt I had already published the stuff piecemeal here, there, and other places. not where it's reviewed by publications in a regular journal, but where you have meetings, and that would be comparable to the CLUES, and so I didn't ever put it in cancer research, which was a mistake. I should have done that.
Are there any other awards or recognitions in your career that you would like to talk about winning?
Well, no, there are several that I had that I will not talk about.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah. So could we discuss your work in Japan?
Well, that was not the chief of research did not do research, but I did institute a method of dividing their money up among their staff by having them have the equivalent of one of these study sections that you'd have to decide what was the most profitable way to spend your limited amount of money. And so I had a committee of representative of the various research groups, and they decide how to divide the money up, and I think that was a big contribution to the Japanese based research. Half of their money came from the United States, and half came from their government that was concerned with health. And so they had a pretty big budget, but the largest part of it was spent on the survivors of the atom bomb. They had collected, thanks to our government sending scientists over there right after the war, a good collection of all of the people that, practically all of the people that had lived through the bomb. They learned where they were stationed, where they were at the moment the bomb went off relative to the place where the greatest exposure to ionizing radiation hit Hiroshima. And so those that were behind a stone wall or that were standing up out in the wide open and survived the burns and so on that killed most of them that were heavily exposed, they had good dose studies. You cannot underestimate the importance of that fact that the United States had been responsible for getting those data on the exposure. So they had all of these survivors, many of them, of course, it was quite small doses. They had all these data, and so they've been following these and having yearly physical exams and keeping track of who dies of what kind of cancer or any other cause of death. So that, by far, the majority of the money from Japan and the United States went for those human studies, and the minor part was for the people that were literally stationed in the laboratories where I was the chairman. There was a tradition there that the director of the place would be from Japan because he'd have to communicate and take care of the Japanese government that was giving their money, and then the chief of research and the vice chairman would be an American citizen, and the on this board of directors the person that took care of finances on the board of directors was also a Japanese, because he'd have to communicate with the Japanese. So our role there was to make sure that the basic research, as chairman, my role was to make sure that the basic research was first class.
Mm-hmm.
And it some of it, most of it was first class research and was published in peer-reviewed journals.
So what prompted you to take this position?
Well, it was because it was 1984 to 1986, a two-year commitment that the person from the United States had to make came when I was 67 or 66 anyhow, and I had already realized that I wasn't going to have access to first class graduate students and postdoctoral fellows anymore because of age, and it was such a fast moving research period that one person by himself couldn't do much. It was a type of research that I've described before where we decided on experiments to do by discussions, and there wasn't anybody to discuss with anymore. All the fun of it would be gone. So that was why I took the job in Japan, and it was one of the most fortunate things I ever did outside of my research, because it was just an entirely new experience living in a Japanese house in a Japanese neighborhood. You couldn't communicate except by sign language and smiles with your neighbors. There was an interesting thing that we learned by experience. My wife, when I was at work, would notice once in a while a neighbor lady's out sweeping our street out in front of our house, our home. And it turns out that the city of Hiroshima, to save money or because they never had it, didn't have a public system for keeping the streets clean. And so the residents were responsible for doing it in front of their own home. It was little experiences like that that were very interesting. The trains ran so precisely by time, both the tremendous number of local trains that brought people into Hiroshima, those that didn't ride by bicycle, came by train. Before World War II, there were hardly any, literally, any cars, automobiles in Japan. It was all trains and bicycles and footwork. So it was just an interesting experience to have, and most of us aren't so fortunate to have that sort of an experience.
So I have one final question for you. So it's kind of a broad question, but kind of a summation as well. So how did the field of cancer research change throughout your career? What sort of the major features?
Well, certainly it changed remarkably. When I started in 1945, there was still perhaps a majority of the members of the scientific organization, the American Association for Cancer Research, perhaps even a majority of them were, like Dr. Rush, clinicians that were interested in cancer research. And so that made the organization different in its orientation in 1945 when I came into it. It was at the tail end, actually, of that era, when the clinicians played a major role in the association. Dr. Rush was a leader in the association. And similarly, within our own department, there just weren't any graduate students or postdoctoral fellows, and so Potter, who joined with Dr. Rush, was it 1940 approximately? He'd come back from a postdoctoral over in Europe because of the upheaval of the nearness of the start of World War II, and that was when he came with McArdle. And then Jim Miller came, and then I came, and Jerry Mueller was a graduate student after his MD. During the war, he left as a student employee here, where he was truly interested in cancer research. He left to go to medical school, so he continued to have science rather than go into service. And so he was around more as a student. I came next, and then Betty Miller, and then Charlie Heidelberger. We were a very closely knit group, and while we each had our own research program, we had seminars together regularly every week, and discussed our work as the tradition began then, that is continued to today. And also we acted as what we called a journal club. We talked each week about, when we met, about interesting, relevant articles that we'd read during the week. And it was during one of those that Betty Miller presented one that had great influence on our department. Someone had found that substituting fluorine for carbon in an amino acid did not change its ability to be recognized by an enzyme, but caused it to poison the enzyme, because the enzyme would recognize it, but it couldn't spit it out, as you might say an enzyme does after it's done its job.
Yeah, you've mentioned.
So it had poisoned it. And Heidelberger used that principle then in the fluorouracil experiments, and I eventually used it in the difluoromethyl ornithine radioactive experiments after the difluoromethyl ornithine was synthesized. Then the radioactive compounds were synthesized. These all began when we were a tight group. There was one telephone in the group. We were operating in two floors of the building that was built for us by a grant from McArdle, a gift from McArdle, isn't that right, Betty?
That's right.
And we didn't have the personnel to operate more than two floors, and so radiology was put into the other two floors. When Temin came, he was in a miserable basement room of the McArdle building until we got our new building that you're presently in built. Now it is just entirely different, and it was entirely different when I matured in the department, where we met with these weekly meetings of our own groups and discussed our research, but we did a lot of that day by day as we, in a small laboratory, we discussed. But we discussed them there, but we also discussed what we had read in the literature. And that was entirely different, having those individual groups, and continuing it today as the whole department meeting to present their research to other members of the department, with the idea that having it critiqued here would be as tough a evaluation of your research program as you'd get anywhere. If your ideas flew in our Friday meetings nowadays, we would be pretty good, certain that they'd be received well on a national scale and for publication. So in that way, there is a big difference between then, when we all have maybe two telephones, one in our laboratory, one in our office. Then there was only one for the whole department, and you hardly ever knew it. Telephones on the campus were by the old-fashioned way, where you were, where there was in the basement of the physics building over here, there was a bunch of ladies with boards where they'd punch in the cords into the particular places that they should be to make a telephone connection. Just entirely different world. It was so much slower. We were employed more as laborers almost than as scientists. Betty Miller and I would spend many hours a week mixing our animal diets in the diet room, and taking care of our animals ourselves, treating them with carcinogens ourselves. Just entirely different. Nowadays, you buy all your chemicals. You don't have to come into the lab nights and weekends like we did, because you can get more done in less time. You can get more done in a week than we, in a day than we could get done in a month or a year, I think. It's just an entirely different world.
All right, great. Well, thank you very much.